All right, good afternoon, everyone. Let's get started. I just really want to begin, as they say, posting b'chvod Hasania. You always have to begin with a special thank you to your hosts. I really want to recognize and thank Isaac Neuberger, Aaron Gibber, Rich Rubin for hosting us here downtown in these beautiful offices with the beautiful view. I always say it's worth it just to come for the view. The Torah is a wonderful bonus. The food is even an additional bonus. But thank you so much for opening up your place of work to our spiritual pursuits as well. And a very special thank you also to Nathan Adler, who has really been our point person in helping to arrange this. And I also want to thank the executive director of our show, Julia Shainman, who literally just came back from an executive director's conference and was helping with the logistics as well, even while away. It's an incredible opportunity. It's a real personal privilege to be able to come downtown, to be able to learn with all of you. And it's always, I think I say this every lunch and learn, that it's always so beautifully inspiring for me to see professionals who spend their days trying to make a difference in their respective fields, making a difference in the world, and yet your lunch hour, which I'm sure is pretty sacred time, given the fact that everybody's pulled in different directions, and here using it to learn and using it to grow is something so beautiful and something so special. So with that, let's begin. So I want to draw your attention, being that this week's parsha, we talk about different things at these lunch and learns. I don't remember the last lunch and learn we had here. I think it might have May?
Not here.
Right, and by a different law firm. But May. Okay, we speak about different topics. But this week, being that the weekly parsha, the weekly Torah portion, is that of Vayera, I figured we spend a little bit of time focusing on that. And specifically, perhaps one of the most enigmatic and difficult stories in the entire Chumash, the story of the Akedah. If you take a look at number one on your sheet, the Torah says as follows, Vayi achar hadvarim ha'ele. And it was after these events, whatever these events are not so important right now, but the Torah is giving us the flow of the narrative. It was after these events, Avraham Avinu, Abraham is emerging as the dominant monotheist on the stage of humanity. And what happens? Va'elokim nisa es Avram. God tested Avram. Now let's remember, this is not the first of Abraham's tests. According to most opinions, this is actually the last of Abraham's tests. He tests him. What does he say? Vayomer elav Avram, vayomer inenu. So God calls out to Avram. Avram says, I'm here, ready to answer the call. Vayomer, God says, Kach nas bincha es yichidcha asher ahavta es Yitzchak. Take your son, your only son, the one who you love, Yitzchak, velech lecha el eretz ha-Moria. And go to the land of Moria. Go to, right, remember, Avraham Avinu was already in the land of Israel, or Canaan as it's known. Go to what's Hara Moria, which will be the future site of the first and second temples, the third temple speedily in our days. Va'aleu sham li'ola alachat ha'arim asher omar elecha. And Avram, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take your son to Mount Moriah, and I want you to sacrifice him as an ola, as a burnt offering. An incredible, you see, the problem with a lot of these stories that we have in Bereishis is because we're so familiar with them, and the truth is we know how they end, that sometimes it loses a little bit of its dramatic impact. But imagine for a moment you're looking at this story for the very first time. Avraham Avinu, who has been the man of God from the beginning, who every single time God says jump, Abraham asks how high. Whatever God asks, Abraham is always willing to answer the call. And here God asks him to do something which seemingly defies comprehension. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avraham Avinu, I want you to take your one and only son, the very son for whom you waited so many years, a son that you had with Sarah, and I want you to offer him up as an ola, as a burnt offering. So we know how the story ends, right? The good news, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, right? But the story ends well. We'll discuss it actually in just a little bit, where Avram is not asked to follow through. Avram is not asked to actually slaughter his son, but instead the story has a beautiful ending. There is collateral damage. According to most opinions, the death of Sarah is ultimately related to her hearing the news of the Akedah. But Avram passes the test. Yitzchak goes his way. Avram goes his way. What I want to spend a little bit of time this afternoon on is what exactly is the takeaway message. You know, remember, the Torah is not a storybook. The Torah is a book of laws. And so whenever you see a story is only included because of its legal, moral, or ethical implications. There is no story that is told because, hey, God thought this would be interesting for us to know. The story is always there because it teaches us some kind of lesson. So the fundamental question I'd like to try to explore this afternoon is, what is the message? What is the lesson of the Akedah? I can tell you what the lesson is not. If you hear a voice that tells you to go and sacrifice your children, right? So first of all, number one, don't listen. That's number one. Number two, seek help. And number three, whatever voice it is, it's definitely not God, right? Because God does not ask us to do these kind of things. So what's the message of the story? What is it that I'm supposed to learn? What is the takeaway? What's the moral? What's the lesson? So I want to begin by sharing with you two polar opposite approaches. The first is that of the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard, and you can see I have a little bit of a biography over here, was a theologian, a poet, social critic, who, interestingly enough, was fascinated with this story of the Akedah. He was so fascinated that he wrote a book about it. The book is called Fear and Trembling, where Kierkegaard advances four different narratives of the story. He gives four different possibilities as to what the story meant, what was the takeaway message. I don't want to present myself as, I don't dabble in Danish philosophers usually, but it happens to be Rabbi Soloveitchik quotes Kierkegaard. And in an essay that I saw by the Rav, I was fascinated by this idea. So I read this particular book of Kierkegaard, and it's fascinating. So Kierkegaard ponders this question, and he wonders, what is the message of the Akedah? What is the message? What's the? I'm the reader. Everything I read in the Torah is supposed to endow me with some type of life lesson. What is the takeaway? Kierkegaard writes in number two. This is a quote. He says, "Ethics is universal. It consists of general rules, but the love of God is particular. It is an I-thou personal relationship. What Abraham underwent during the trial was a teleological." I'm happy we're doing this at a law firm, because I'm assuming all of you know what that means. I didn't know what it meant, so we'll give the definition in just a moment. Was a teleological suspension of the ethical. That is, a willingness to let the I-thou love of God overrule the universal principles that bind humans to one another. So first of all, if you want a definition of teleological, you can see the bolded paragraph at the end of two. Teleological means in regard to the end. If you are hungry and you eat something with the goal of no longer being hungry, you made a teleological decision. You acted by eating so as to achieve the end of no longer being hungry. So Kierkegaard advances the following idea. There's something called ethics. There's something called ethics. Ethics are an immutable body of agreed upon rules. Ethics are independent to a certain degree by religion. They may be informed by religion, but ethics stand on their own. In a normative ethical code, I don't know if it's number one, two, or three, but there's a basic rule. You don't slaughter your own children. That's part of ethics. That's just part of an ethical code. Abraham hears from God. God tells him, "I want you to slaughter your son." So Kierkegaard posits that that Abraham faces this incredible dilemma. Which is more important, ethics or my relationship with God? Ethics or my relationship with God? So Kierkegaard posits that what did Abraham do? He suspended ethics and instead decided to go with God. Ethically, Kierkegaard said what God told Abraham to do was wrong. There's no two ways about it, right? There's no machlokis about this. There's no tzvedinin, right? There's no two halachas, there's no two ideas. It was wrong. So Avram was faced with a decision. Do I follow the ethical standard? In which case, I have to say, God, I'm sorry. You're God, but there are ethics independent of you, and I cannot comply with what it is that you're asking of me because it is wrong? Or does my relationship with God supersede my own personal ethical standards? So it's amazing in Kierkegaard's mind. So according to Kierkegaard, did Avraham do the right thing? See, he doesn't really weigh in on that so much. But what he does say is, Avraham did something unethical. Compliance with the word of God was unethical. But you could see it in his words. At the end of the day, the teleological suspension of the ethical. So what the Akedah says, Kierkegaard, is that Avraham suspended his ethics in order to place the emphasis on his relationship with God. A willingness to let the I, thou love of God overrule the universal principles that bind humans to one another. So it's interesting, by the way, is that in Kierkegaard's model, the message of the Akedah is that life is sometimes filled with conflict between ethics and between religion. And what do you do when your ethics and your religion conflict? Avraham shows us a model where you choose God over ethics. Kierkegaard posits that does not mean that that was the right decision. And in fact, in one of his narratives, the way he understands the story, or the way he feels the story should have gone, is that Avraham says to God, God, I love you, and I owe everything to you, but I cannot comply with what you're asking me. Because what you're asking me to do is something immoral. What you're asking me to do is something unethical. And even though you're God, even though you're God, I cannot suspend my ethics in the face of your command. Now, of course, the underpinning of Kierkegaard's approach is that there is a system of morality and ethics independent of God. And so according to Kierkegaard, right, if he was here, he would tell us that ultimately, again, what's the Musar Haskil? I don't know if he would use those words, but what's the takeaway message, right? What's the takeaway from this? That life is filled with clashes between our ethics and our religion. Be careful how you choose. That's Kierkegaard. Rabbi Soloveitchik says the exact opposite. Look at the Rav number 3. So Rabbi Soloveitchik actually wrote about this in an essay, an incredible essay, titled Majesty and Humility. You could find it. It's actually online. He printed it in Tradition, which is a journal. I think this might have been either in the late 70s or the early 80s. An incredible, important essay called Majesty and Humility. Now, the truth is, it's part of a much bigger theme. But look what the Rav says over here, number 3. What does man cherish more than intellect? What does man cherish more than the intellect around which his sense of dignity is centered? What does man cherish more than the intellect around which his sense of dignity is centered? So here, Rabbi Soloveitchik writes this as a true brisker, right? Remember again, Rabbi Soloveitchik was part of perhaps one of the most noble families within the Jewish people, the House of Brisk, right? Brisk was known for its analytical idea. The approach of Brisk is that emotion is weakness, intellect is king. And remember, this manifested itself in many different ways. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes that when he took leave of his father, you know, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik was brought to America before Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik came. Because Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik was elected to be the Rosh Yeshiva of what was then Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, Yeshiva University. And Rabbi Soloveitchik writes that he remembers saying goodbye to his father. And he said, how did I say goodbye to my father? We shook hands. He says, Rav writes, I never remember my father telling me that he loved me. Now, by the way, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, I know my father loved me very much. I knew it. But I never heard him say it. Because in Brisk, a statement of emotion was a sign of weakness. Emotions cloud things. Emotions blur the intellect. Emotions blur clear thought. So in Brisk, emotions were kept in check, and intellect was king. So if I write Rabbi Soloveitchik, what does man cherish more in life than his intellect? And by the way, for good reason. What separates us from the animal kingdom? What separates us? So really, it's speech. But speech is the greatest manifestation of intellect. Right? The power of speech is I could take intellectual thought and I could translate it into a communicable method, right? I could go ahead and take my thoughts, my ideas, my intellectual constructs, and instead of them living up here in my head, I could use speech to translate them and communicate them to you. Our greatest, the centerpiece of man's identity is his intellect. Precisely because of the supremacy of the intellect in human life, the Torah requires at times the suspension of the authority logos. So says Rabbi Soloveitchik something so incredibly amazing. There are times where in order to go ahead and demonstrate our fidelity and allegiance to God, what does God demand of us? A suspension of the intellect. God says, I'm going to ask you to do things that make absolutely no sense to you. They're going to defy your intellect. They're going to go against your intellect. And it's in those moments that you demonstrate the highest level of fidelity and allegiance. Man, Rabbi Soloveitchik writes about this so beautifully. Man defeats himself by accepting norms that the intellect cannot assimilate into its normative system. The Judaic concept of chok represents human surrender and human defeat. Man, an intellectual being, ignores the logos and burdens himself with laws whose rational motif he cannot grasp. He withdraws from the rationalistic position. In a word, withdrawal is required in all areas of human experience and endeavor. Whatever is most significant, whatever attracts man the most, he must give up. He must be given up. What happens after man makes this movement of recoil and retreats? God may instruct him to resume his march to victory and move onward in conquest and triumph. The movement of recoil redeems the forward movement, and readiness to accept defeat purges the uncontrollable lust for victory. Once man has listened and retreated, he may later be instructed to march straight forward to victory. Abraham was told to withdraw and to defeat himself by giving Isaac away. He listened, God accepted Isaac, but did not retain him. God returned him to Avraham. Ve'yirash zaracha es shar oivav. Avraham found victory in retreat. So this is an incredibly profound idea. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes that he actually agrees with Kierkegaard in that the essence of the Akedah was this clash between man's, Rabbi Soloveitchik calls it intellect, but the truth is it's what Kierkegaard called man's personal morality or ethics. The notion of an Akedah was offensive to Avraham. How do we know that it was offensive to Avraham? Because the Medrash tells us that one of Avraham's major campaign slogans for monotheism was stop child sacrifice. Child sacrifice was all the rave, but that doesn't sound right. Right, meaning child sacrifice, it was a linchpin in polytheistic service. People, this was it. And by the way, you could understand it, because how do you demonstrate your greatest love and allegiance to God? By giving God that which is closest and most beloved to you. Avram campaigned against this. And now God tells him, I need you to do something that is intellectually offensive. I need you to do something that runs against the very grain of your intellect. So it's amazing, Kierkegaard and Rabbi Soloveitchik are saying this, they start from the same point. Kierkegaard is saying, God asked Avram to do something that was unethical and immoral. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, God asked Avram to do something that was offensive to his intellect. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, herein lies the ultimate test of fidelity to the Jew. Whereas Kierkegaard understands that there is a system of morality and ethics that exists independent of God, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, there is no morality independent of God. There are no ethics independent of God. Our system of morality and ethics is derived by what HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us to do and not to do. If God says do it, it's moral. If God says don't do it, I don't know that it automatically means it's immoral, but it may be immoral. It may be immoral. That's how our system is defined. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, and this is incredibly amazing, and perhaps one of the most difficult aspects of Judaism, where there are things in Judaism that I say to myself, this doesn't make sense. It's okay to say that, by the way, right? The lightning bolt is not going to come down and hit you. Right? It doesn't make sense. I just don't understand why God is asking me of this. So sometimes it's like inane things. Like, God tells me I can't wear shatnez. I can't wear woolen linen. Really? God, like, you don't have bigger fish to fry than my woolen linen, right? This is like the big thing on the smorgasbord of cosmic issues, is if Silber's wearing woolen linen or not. Sort of things, but I'm not offended by that. I don't understand, but I'm not offended by that. But then there are other things that the Torah tells us that the truth is, it goes against some of the grain of our very moral ethics. Look, one of the greatest challenges, I will tell you, that I often encounter personally, is the Torah tells us that when the Jewish people entered into the land of Israel, what were they supposed to do with the seven nations? What do you do with the seven nations? you wipe them out. Today we'd call that genocide. We'd call that genocide. Right? Wiping out everyone? Who ever heard of such a thing like this? It's offensive. And it's even more offensive to us because the truth is we've been on the receiving end of that for so many millennia. What does that mean? Now, the truth is, yes, it doesn't mean they have to wipe them out. It means we tell them they have to leave. But if they stay and they fight, then we fight back. But still, the notion goes against my very sensitivities. So what do you do in life when your morality conflicts with God's morality? Whose morality wins? Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, the entire message of the Akedah is God's morality must always take precedence over my personal morality, even if I find God's morality a bit offensive. And herein lies the greatness of our patriarch Abraham. This was the Akedah. You're telling me to do something that intellectually I don't understand, morally I don't understand, ethically I don't understand. You're telling me to do something that goes against the very grain of what I've been telling people since I became your ambassador on this earth. But what do you do when your morals conflict with God's morals? And don't we encounter this all the time? Especially, again, we see this even in greater society as everything becomes much more progressive. We find those of us who live in the world and want to be a part of the world and want to contribute to society often find ourselves locked in this internal push and pull. I have Torah, that's God's will, but I also have society. And where do I come out on that? Right, maybe that's a different discussion, but that's the message of the Akedah. When your morals conflict with God's morals, at the end of the day, who wins? So amazing enough, Rabbi Soloveitchik telling us that Avram emerges heroic from this story. Why is he heroic? Because essentially he yielded before God. He bent his knee before God. He said, God, I disagree. I don't know that he articulated that, but I guarantee you he must have felt it. I disagree, but what am I going to do? You're God, and I bend my knee in subservience before you. So whereas Kierkegaard says that Avraham failed the test of the Akedah, that it's possible that the entire test was Avraham supposed to stand up to God and say, no, we don't do this. There's a system of morality and ethics. According to Rabbi Soloveitchik, Avraham comes out as an incredible hero, a man who is willing to put his own personal feelings, his own morality, his own ethics on the side, and bend his knee in allegiance and fidelity to God. But I want to share with you one more approach. Because the truth is, I'll tell you why this always bothers me. The Akedah, in general, this particular episode, plays such a central role, especially in the liturgy of the high holidays. Right? In the Tfilos of the Yomim Noraim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, we mention the Akedah so many times. The merit of the Akedah, the merit of the Akedah, the merit of this. So why? There's something about the Akedah. That, now, obviously, Rabbi Soloveitchik teaches us an incredible lesson. But there seems to be something almost so much more personal about this Akedah that we're supposed to learn. So I want to show you something amazing. If you turn the page. So if you look at number 4. If you look at number 4, so there's an amazing pasuk. So fast forward to the end of the Akedah. So all right, I ruined the surprise for you already. Everything works out okay. God says to Avram in number 4, Vayomer, al tishlach yadcha lanar. Do not touch the boy, right? Do not lay your hand on the child, meaning don't slaughter him. Va'al ta'as lo mu'uma, don't do anything to him. Ki ato yadati, ki erei alokim ato, because I know that you fear me. And you have not withheld your one and only son from me. So again, in the 11th hour, Avram is holding the knife. Yitzchak is tied up like an animal ready to be sacrificed. And God says to Avram, stop. Stop. Don't do anything. Al ta'as lo mu'uma, don't even make a mark. So Rashi in number 5 says something absolutely amazing. You see, Rashi is a reactive commentary. Rashi only comments when he sees something troubling in the verse. So if you're looking at this verse, there is a redundancy. What does the verse say? Al tishach yad chalanar, don't go ahead and touch him. And what? Al taslam u'uma, don't go ahead and don't do the slightest thing. Well, obviously, if you're telling me not to put a hand on the kid, obviously that means don't do anything to him. So Rashi says, why the double verbiage? Look what he writes. Amr lo. So this is incredible and almost difficult to understand. When God tells Avram to stop, Avram says, why? Why? Amarlo, im kein lechinam basi lakan. If that's the case, that you don't want me to do anything, this whole thing has been a waste. This whole thing has been a waste. I've spent all this time, all this energy to get here. And for what? Nothing? We're not even going to do anything? So Avram says to God, you know what, God? I have an idea. Let me make a little scratch. Let me make a little cut. Let me draw a little bit of blood. So at least it should be that like something sacrificial happened over here. Amar lo, al ta'as lo mumah. God says, no, don't touch Yitzchak. Don't make a mark, don't do anything. And the question is obvious, which is, we'll have to give lunch after the shiur next time. This level of participation. Hey, meaning, what? What is going on over here? Avram just heard from God, don't do anything to the boy. What should Avram's reaction be? Right, the biblical backflip, right? I mean, this is incredible. This is incredible. He told me, oh, phew, such a sigh of relief. Thank God I don't have to do anything. Avram now is pushing God. Let me do something. Okay, you don't want me to slaughter? Fine, I won't slaughter my kid. But let me make a little cut. Let me draw a little bit of blood. Let me do something. I already came all this way. I shouldn't come back with nothing. Let me do something. What's going on over here? So I'll share with you an incredible medrash. If you take a look at number 6, the medrash says as follows, quite amazing. Vayomar Shlishi. So the medrash, I'm picking up a little bit of the middle of the medrash. So the medrash writes over here as follows. Avram reaches Har HaMoriah on the third day. It took him 3 days to travel. Now the obvious question was, he was in Hebron. It's not a 3-day trip from Hebron to Jerusalem. It's not a 3-day trip. Hey, so why is Avram Avinu taking 3 days to get there? So the medrash writes, so why is it that he went ahead and it took him 3 days? So listen to this. So the Medrash here has, let me tell you this outside a little bit. The Medrash discusses that when Avram Avinu was going to the Akedah, the Satan tried to derail. Now let's talk about the Satan for just a moment. Do not confuse the Satan with the concept of Satan, right? We do not believe in Satan. We do not believe that there is an opposing force to God, right? A counterbalance force to God that seeks to undermine HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We don't believe in that. We don't believe in the devil. We don't have that in Judaism. So what is the Satan? And nor do we believe like that there's a little guy in a little red suit who sits on your shoulder, right, with a pitchfork and horns and a tail who tries to convince you to sin. We don't believe in that either. What we when we speak about the Satan, we speak about the Yetzer, the evil inclination. We speak about the fact that God created us with certain internal self-sabotaging mechanisms, right? You ever have something in life where you're trying to accomplish something, you're trying to do something, and it just doesn't get done? And of course, the first reaction when something doesn't go my way, get done, my first reaction, of course, is, let me go ahead and blame someone. Right? Who am I going to blame? But then when I go ahead and I really think about it, I realize, you know what? I sabotaged myself. I pulled the rug out from under myself. Why? We do this all the time. We self-sabotage. Why? That's the Yetzer Hara. That's the Satan. God created us with, for some reason, with these self-sabotaging mechanisms, which makes sense, because there's no growth without friction. Those self-sabotaging mechanisms create the friction that in and of themselves are the engine for growth. So the Medrash says over here, what happens? Avram is on the way to the Akedah. So what happens when he gets to he's going to the Akedah? The Satan keeps trying to derail him. What does that really mean? Translation is, Avraham is struggling. He's struggling with this. Avram is going to carry through. He's going to do it. He's going to come through. But you know, sometimes we think that Avram hears from God. God says to Avram, Avram, I want you to slaughter your only son. Avram says, okay. Right? He doesn't just say, okay. This was a struggle. He's doing it. He's saddling the donkey. He's willing to do it. He's working hard. But at the end of the day, it is a profound struggle for Avram Avinu. So says the Medrash, one of the struggles came about. What happened? Second line, number 6. Nasalif name Nar Gadol. So what happens? The Satan comes along, and the Satan makes himself like what? Like a big river. Like a big river in front of Avram. What does Avram do? He goes into the river, and he's up until his neck in the water. He calls out to God. He says, God, like he borrows the verse from Psalms, Hoshi'ini Elokim ki bo mayim ad nefesh. He's up to his neck in water. He says, God, listen, here's the deal. I'm willing to do what you ask me, but I'm going to drown. I'm going to drown. So either you go ahead and you step in and you help me out, or it just all ends over here. And immediately what happened? The waters parted. The waters parted. Aram Avinu was able to go on to the Akedah. Rav Schwab, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, in number 8, point says something so beautiful. What's the message? You know, in general, Medrash is not meant to be understood literally. It's a way that the rabbis convey different messages and ideas. So what's the message? Aram Avinu was up to his neck in water. So what's the message? Look what Rabbi Schwab writes in number 8. It's so beautiful. V'nira sheyadua shebeloshon chazal hamayim meramzim lechesed. Water is often a reference to chesed, to kindness. To kindness, right? Chesed means charitable kindness. So water, just like water is sustaining, water is often an allusion, a metaphor for chesed, for kindness. Va'ish ledin, fire, usually is a reference or a metaphor for justice. So watch this. Im kein, yesh lomar, she'atzas ha-satan she'asa lifneim nar gadol, ha'isa she'tisla be'ishu midas ha-chesed. Listen, I'm going to paraphrase this outside, to borrow from Rabbi Schwab a little bit. What does it mean that Avraham Avinu is up to his neck in water? Water is chesed, water is kindness. What's happening in the Akedah? What's happening as Avraham Avinu is on his way? He's drowning in water, which means he's drowning in chesed. Avraham Avinu says, God, I don't know that I could do this. This is not me. This is not me. I am not the guy who slaughters anything besides supper. Right? I am not the guy who... I don't do this. This is not me. You know who I am. I'm the man who sits by his tent right after circumcision at the age of 99 to be able to welcome guests. I am the person who embraces people. I am the person who brings people closer to God. I am not the person who goes ahead and slaughters his son. Ki bo mayim ad nefesh, as Aram Avinu is saying, I am drowning in chesed. This is not me. This goes against the grain of who I am. But what does Aram Avinu do? What does he do, says Rav Schwab? He powers forward. The water splitting is the metaphor for, Aram said, you know what, it's not me, but it is who I have to become. Because sometimes life calls upon you to become someone different than you are. Because sometimes your circumstances demand that you change your personalistic orientation. Because sometimes life's circumstances demand that you evolve into someone else. What the Medrash is saying over here is that Aram Avinu is on his way to the Akedah, and he's steeped in water. He's about to drown in the water. I am an Isha Chesed. I've built my life on the midah of loving kindness. And now you want me to do something that is cruel. You want me to do something that is emotionally indifferent. You want me to do something that is so harsh. It's not me. And then he has this epiphany. It's not me now, but it is clearly who I have to become. And what the Medrash is highlighting over here is Avraham Avinu finding the strength to evolve and to become someone fundamentally different. And now we understand the Rashi. Go back up now for a moment to number 5. What did Rashi say? God calls out to Avraham. He says, Avraham, stop! Stop! And Avraham says, Avraham's response, come on. We're just getting started over here, right? Why do we have to stop? Okay, I won't slaughter him. Let me draw a little bit of blood. What is Avraham Avinu saying to God? What Avraham Avinu lost it? What's going on over here? What is he saying to God? I summoned all of this strength to become someone different. You need to give me the outlet to express that strength. Do you know how much it took me to change from the man of water to the man of fire? Do you know how much it took me to change from the Isha Chesed, from the man of loving kindness, to the man of strict justice? Do you know how much it took me to defy my own morality to accept your morality? I need to do something with this now. I've built myself up. I've summoned all of this internal courage, all of this internal strength, and I've metamorphosized. I've changed into someone else. I've risen to the occasion. And now I can't do anything with it. Now you want me to change back? To which HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, yes. You summoned the courage to change, and now I need you to summon the same courage to change back. And perhaps this is part of the fundamental message of the Akedah. We often go through life thinking, and we are born with certain predispositions in many different ways. Chazal already speak about this, right? That if someone is born underneath the constellation of Mars, they're going to have certain dispositions for spilling blood. But Chazal also say, you might be born with certain predispositions, but what you choose to do with those predispositions, that's your choice. That's the choice you have. Life is filled with choices, and who we become and what we become is our choice. And even if we start out in a certain way, we always have the capacity and the ability to change. Do you want to know what the takeaway message of the Akedah is? It's not if God appears and tells you to slaughter your kids, you should listen. We already spoke about that before. Don't do it. I want to go on record as saying, don't do it. Don't listen, don't do it. The message of the Akedah is that dramatic, cathartic, personalistic change is always possible. There is no such thing as having something you cannot change about yourself. There is no such thing as having a behavior, an approach, a midah that is so embedded that it cannot be altered or maybe obliterated. You'll say, impossible, this is who I am, this is what I am. That's the message of the Akedah. Avram went from a isha chesed, a man of kindness, to a man of strict justice. A man of water to a man of fire. And he changed, and by the way, it doesn't end there. Had he changed once, that would be dramatic. But what does he do? He changes and then what? He's forced to change back. And by the way, this could also be why the Akedah is such a dominant part of our Yamim Yoram, of our high holiday liturgy. You see, we often think that we're talking about the Akedah in order to draw on the merits of our forefathers. That's true. But there's another message here as well. What are the high holidays all about? They're all about the capacity and ability to change. What is the greatest change story in the entire Chumash? The greatest change story in the entire Tanakh is the Akedah. We don't think about it that way, but it is the greatest change story. Avram going from a man of chesed to a man of din. Avram yielding in his own morality to the morality of God. Avram going from water to fire and then back to water again. So if we bring everything together, it turns out that this incredible story really gives us two dramatic life lessons. Leaving aside Kierkegaard for now, because we won't, interesting to learn, but we won't include him as part of our takeaway. Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Schwab, both giving us two incredible lessons. Rabbi Soloveitchik teaching us that there are many times in life where my personal morals conflict with God's morals. It happens all of the time. And the question is, whose side do you choose? And it's easy to be flippant and to say, of course I always choose God. But the truth is, sometimes it's not so easy to choose God. But you know, sometimes the first step in being successful in conflict, internal conflict, is at least recognizing the conflict. And recognizing that there are many times in life that what I believe to be correct and true is not necessarily what God believes to be correct and true. And that our job is to be Abrahamic in nature and to find a way to bend our knee before God and to accept God's morality over our own. And second takeaway is the message ultimately of Rav Schwab, that change is exceptionally difficult, but change is always possible. No matter how embedded the behavior, no matter how embedded the lifestyle, no matter how embedded the approach, if Avram could change and change back, then we truly have the ability to change anything and everything about ourselves as well. Thank you. Correct.
So is that man against God? Is my view,
right. I would say it's almost like society against God. Society determines, you know, norms. So that will change society and society. But yes. I'm going to go to the hospital.
He gives it a higher status.
Correct. And the status of the cover decides something else,
that's where you are as well, 100%.